In a sense, the entire Chumash, entire Torah, is dedicated to basically one topic, and that topic is creating a world with a God consciousness. To what extent we notice this, and to what extent we're oblivious of this in a general sense, really depends on our own sensitivity. In this week's parsha, specifically in Akev, not only is there an issue of a God consciousness, but the God consciousness manifests itself, I think, in one primary area, where if you don't notice it, it's not like you won't understand the parsha. It just seems to be a very pronounced subtext which exists. From the very beginning it says, V'ya'ekev tishma'un, you know, since you'll listen to the mishpatim, you'll guard them, you'll keep them, you'll guard the covenant which God made with you and with your forefathers. And then it goes on to say that, and you'll love God, you will be greatly blessed, you'll be blessed with children, and you'll be blessed to pri admasecha degancha v'sirashcha v'yitzarecha shagar alafecha v'ashtaras tzonecha aldamash v'nishbal v'sech l'seislach. That you'll be blessed with all kind of produce, your storehouses will be filled, and all kinds of, the land will give you produce. Later on, in the same section, it moves on, and it's really the end of what I would say is the introduction over here. It talks about having all of this good, having all of this plenty, and then v'achalta v'savata uvirachta. You'll eat, you'll be satiated, and you will bless God. The subtext that I'm referring to is subtext of food. And maybe, I know there's many jokes about Jews and food and so on. It's not that we created holidays just that we had food. And I don't think it's that God created food that we should have holidays. But the use of the food is certainly needed in order to create this this relationship with God. And let me just lay out a couple of things. Among the references over here, aside from, really is one of only two blessings which are written in the Torah. You know, we in the what I would call the rabbinic life, when I say rabbinic life, I mean life of rabbis, I mean life of what's sometimes called rabbinic Judaism, as opposed to Torah law, there is at least a perception of many prayers and many blessings and many things which are done. I mean, in fact, the Talmud tells us the Jew is supposed to make 100 blessings a day. 100 blessings. You pray 3 times a day. Blessings on food, before food, after food. Blessings on all kinds of other occasions. When it comes down to it, blessings, for the most part, are a rabbinic invention. It's a rabbinic invention based upon a Torah ideal. What's the Torah ideal? The only two blessings you see in the Torah are that the Kohanim are supposed to bless the people, and that one is supposed to eat, be satisfied, be satiated, and make a blessing. And by the way, when you realize those only two Torah-level blessings, it really is quite amazing that many Jews, if not most Jews, do not have the custom of the Kohanim blessing the people outside of the land of Israel. You'd say, I mean, you realize now, it's a Torah law. It's a Torah law. So why don't they do it outside the land of Israel? That there needs to be a degree of happiness involved in the blessing. There needs to be, basically, the difference in these two blessings is when you make a blessing after food, you're really thanking God for food. When the Kohen is blessing the people, what the Kohen is then doing is he's serving as a conduit whereby God is really blessing the people. And those are two very different types of blessings. So really, the only real blessing which exists in the Torah is the blessing regarding food. Again, after food, because the blessing of the Kohen is not himself making a blessing towards God as much as him serving as the conduit of blessing the people, whereby God's blessing is flowing down. And that's why when the Kohen gives the blessing, if you've been in synagogue when this happens, where they put their hands out because the blessing flows through them, and that's why they cover it up, because it's divine blessing which is coming through, and according to the tradition, one is not even supposed to look directly once you cover their eyes or close their eyes, because that one is really at that moment witnessing this this divine occurrence. But therefore, what has become such a benchmark of rabbinic Judaism, namely this blessing, and by the way, let's not make any mistake about it. the blessings is what creates a God consciousness within our regular life, which means instead of just eating an apple, I mean, if you want to see the image very clearly, having an apple in one's mouth does not make one a religious person, right? The apple itself doesn't do it. I mean, you have the whole animal kingdom eats as well. It is the blessing before one eats the apple which creates this God consciousness. And Jews, again, according to the rabbinic sensitivity, are supposed to make so many blessings during the day. That's an order to foster, to create, to make sure that this God consciousness remains with us all the time. If you make 100 blessings a day, you will find yourself constantly, or shall we say, at small intervals, having God on your lips. But it's interesting that the only blessing which is of the Torah level is the blessing which was said after food, not before food. And, you know, the Talmud discusses this a little bit and says the fact that you'd make a blessing after you eat serves as the basis to make a blessing before you eat. Because if you make a blessing after you're already full and satisfied, how much more appreciation are you going to have before you actually eat in order to thank God for that food which is there? Because, you know, after one is satisfied, one gets a little bit lazy. I mean, it's almost like you eat a good meal and then you take a little bit of a nap. It's that now there is a lack of sensitivity at that point. When a person's very hungry, you know, a person's walking in the desert, has no food, sees the food, they'll say almost automatically what? They'll say, thank God for the food, because now the food is there. So before you eat, there's more of a need, there's more of a desire, more of a sensitivity, and therefore there's more of a willingness to thank God. And therefore the Torah stresses to thank God after one eats. That itself, as I said, is interesting, but as far as the Talmud is concerned, that becomes the source for thanking God before one eats as well. So aside from this general statement, you know, you're going to follow the word of God, follow the laws, and so on, and then you'll have enough food for yourself, your animals, you'll have children, which, by the way, is interesting. It's also called pre. It's also called offspring. It's also called something which grows. You'll have food for yourselves, food for your animals. But then, as I said, it gets to this climax, v'yachalta v'savat v'rachta. You'll eat, you'll be satisfied, and you'll bless. Along the way in this week's portion, we also have a whole discussion about the man, the manna which received from heaven, which itself creates an interesting concept. By the way, did they make a bracha on the man? They did make a bracha. What bracha did they make? Yeah, you can't say hamotzi lechem in aretz because it's not true, right? So you say shakol. So there is a whole, or borim nemi zonos, different things that satisfy. There is a difference of opinion what bracha they would have made if in fact they did make a bracha on that. And let's leave that for a moment. But if I speak of food creating a God consciousness, what would have been greater than manna which comes from heaven? Which means every time you eat it, every time you see it, it creates that kind of a concept. Through the very end of the parsha, we get to this this section, which is known as the second section of Shema, where it creates a very, very clear relationship. If you follow the word of God, you will have rain. You will have rain in its proper season. You will have food. You will be satisfied. If, on the other hand, you don't follow the word of God, rain won't fall. If you rebel against God, you worship idolatry, then you won't have rain its proper season. You'll end up finding yourself expelled from the land, and so on and so forth, which really creates a very clear interrelationship between people's behavior and the type of life that they're going to have. But what's interesting, again, food serves as the center. Now, there is one other statement over here, which I think is really also quite interesting and probably is really the crux of the issue. It speaks about the land that they are going to go into, this land of Israel. And it says the land of Israel is unlike the land of Egypt, for the land of Egypt is a place where in order to get rain, well, in order to get water, the Nile would overflow. The Nile is this constant water source. On the other hand, it says that Israel is a place that needs rain. Which means, if you just even think about it as a metaphor, in Egypt, if you want to water your crops, you go to the Nile and you work hard and you take the water from the Nile and you irrigate with it. in Israel, in order to get water, the only way that water comes is by lifting your eyes towards heaven and waiting for the rain to fall from heaven. You know, living in a modern society, you know, especially those of us who grew up in a big city, you know, in a big city, not only do you not have a consciousness in terms of rain and things like that, water coming from heaven, you don't even have like a clear consciousness of fruits and vegetables and seasons. You know, you go to your local market and it always has everything. Hopefully, if you're a little bit more sensitive, you realize the prices are not always the same, which is a reflection that there, in fact, are seasons to things. But I think, I'm sure there are a lot of people that grow up in New York or L.A. and other places, and they just, you know, they just always go to the market, and they always have all types of produce, and you don't begin to think about it. When you live in an agricultural society, there becomes a very, very clear relationship. If there is more rain, if there is enough rain, there will be crops. If there are crops, there will be food. If there's food, there'll be money. If there is not rain, there will not be crops, there will not be food, there will not be money, and people will go hungry, and perhaps in extreme examples, people will die. That's very simple. And you know, in the modern world, instead of having that type of sensitivity in terms of water, I think people are much more sensitive in terms of how the stock market is doing, which I don't think that most people begin to realize how much on some level it is related to the same kind of things, because at least certain stocks are going to be impacted by natural disasters and so on, or natural phenomenon. But people, you know, are paying much more attention to the price of gold and to the price of the high techs and new experiments or new things and new products and new pharmaceuticals, and that's where, you know, they'll see their money come through, and they don't realize this relationship. But when we read this verse and says that Israel is not like the land of Egypt, you begin to get the sense that Israel is a place which is literally hardwired for spirituality. By virtue of the fact that in order to get your produce, you must lift your head heavenward and pray to God, Israel becomes a place which creates spiritual experiences. And there are other places in this world, and it says notably Egypt, are places that a person can sort of forget. They forget this relationship. And it says that therefore Israel is not just a place that you need to lift your head heavenward. You need to retain this type of consciousness. And if you don't, you won't be able to remain in this land. If you don't retain that type of an understanding, then this is not the proper land for you. And it's ultimately Jews go into exile because they're unable to retain this type of an experience. Once you realize that that's what the land of Israel is, it becomes particularly interesting that as a stopping point between leaving Egypt and between going into the land of Israel, they do receive the manna from heaven, which becomes a very, very clear lesson in ultimately where food comes from. Don't just think it comes from the local market. Ultimately, man is relying on what comes from heaven. Once we... Yeah. Sure.
Why did they complain about the manna? Could it have any taste they wanted? And then they wanted the leaves
whether it actually had any taste that it wanted or not, it is not something it says in the Torah. That's something which is a rabbinic understanding. And also, it's not necessarily the case that every single person, it tastes like anything that they wanted. It's also possible that that depended on your own spiritual sensitivity. And therefore, people who are on a lower spiritual level, therefore, would of course complain. But it is very interesting how people could be in the desert getting something from heaven. And by the way, that may be part of it. Man has a need to create. Man has a need to be creative. And it's very difficult for many people. I'm not saying for all people. Maybe even for some people. Maybe we really are a very spoiled generation. Would you prefer never to work another day in your life and just have live in a lap of luxury and have everything given to you? Or would you prefer to actually work and do something and create and to be involved? So I think even if everything was taken care of for you, it can, and by the way, it doesn't make a difference who that person is. If it's a wealthy parent, grandparent, uncle. But again, there's no quid pro quo. And you get everything, that creates very often a psychological feeling of inadequacy on your part and this need to want to do something. Now, it's interesting because the Jews in the desert, I think at least some of them, they had a hard time with this. And the hard time may be the next stage, because I just said a moment ago when there's no quid pro quo. But if somebody does something really nice to you, then you begin to feel that you're obligated to them, which itself is interesting. Would you accept an expensive gift from anybody? Why? Because you're a woman and you're afraid what's attached to the gift? Is that being cynical or is that being realistic?
Maybe both.
But it's interesting because once you take something really expensive, then you begin to feel that you're beholden to them. And therefore, if there's somebody who you don't want to be beholden to, you're not going to take that gift. Now, go back to your question. Why are there people who say, I don't want this stuff from heaven, I'd rather get this stuff from Egypt? Because, again, what's the dynamic in Egypt? You go and you pick it up yourself. You work yourself. Then that's exactly what they're describing. It's easy, and you can do it yourself. You do it yourself, and it's easy. Manna from heaven is even easier, but at some level, you realize that it's coming straight from heaven. And when you realize it's coming straight from heaven, you then become beholden. And you may not want to take a gift which comes straight from heaven, because now then you will have certain obligations upon you. By the way, the land of Israel is a land where things are going to be more difficult. You're going to have to work, but there is going to be you're going to retain the relationship with God, which means you're going to have to work, you're going to have to plow, you're going to have to do, but the rain then comes from heaven, which means the land of Israel creates really this partnership. I want to go back a little bit, because now you realize you go from Egypt, you go to the desert, and then you get to the land of Israel. The manna in the desert, at least for me, reminds me of something else. It reminds me of another place, another time, where everything was taken care of, and man didn't have to work very hard, and everything was there for them. And of course, that would be the Garden of Eden. There is something very Eden-like about the time in the desert. You can argue with me that there's various elements which are somewhat different, but there is at least a feeling in the desert. There is something there that really does remind us of being in the Garden of Eden. And on the most basic level, the Garden of Eden is a place that man doesn't need to work. Man is basically hanging out with God, and God provides all of their needs, which itself is a very interesting model. When man has total consciousness that they are indeed hanging out with God, then you don't have to really work. And then God provides everything. By the way, the Talmud has a very interesting discussion. What's better? Is it better to work hard to plant and plow and so on and spend, as it says, at least some of your time working, you know, hard days, honest days work? Or is it better just to sit and wait for God to provide? So it sounds to me that the conclusion is that you can argue about this. There's two different approaches. But the Talmud says that people try to do that, that God would just provide it. It doesn't work for most people. Most people can't do that. Most people, if they try that, it fails. Now, why would it fail? Because ultimately, I would assume that most people are not at that level. Most people are not really on this level that they can just sit and say, okay, God really provide for me and really believe it. And really believe it and therefore create it. The one person who it says that was able to do it there, it says Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Then again, Rav Shimon bar Yochai was a sort of person who can sit in a cave for 12 years and he so much believes that God will take care of him, or 13 years, and he so much believes that God will take care of him, then a stream appears in the cave and he so much believes that God will take care of him, a tree grows in a cave. And if you will believe a tree will grow in a cave, you just wouldn't believe it. That's an impossibility for you. But therefore, Rav Shimon bar Yochai can sit in a cave and it's as if he's in the Garden of Eden, because he really believes it. But for most people don't have that kind of belief. The Garden of Eden was a place that man hung out with God completely. In fact, the scary thing about sin is that when Adam and Eve sinned, what does it then say? It says that they hear the sound of God in the spirit of the day, in the wind of the day. They sense that God is right there. But what do? When they sense that God is there, it says that they go and they hide from the sound of God. And then God says to Adam, says to Eve, why are you hiding? And did you eat from the tree? And so on. Which means that's what sin does to us. That's what a corrupt worldview. That's, and when I say corrupt, don't worry, I'm not talking about corruption which makes the front page of the newspapers. I'm talking about spiritual corruption. I'm talking about lack of having total faith in God. What that does is creates in man this need to hide from God. And by the way, that then becomes very, very similar to the people in the desert who are saying, no, just get us the food back in Egypt the way that it was, is that they don't want to hang out with God. They don't want this intense relationship. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden have this incredible intense relationship with God, and that's why they don't have to work. That's why they don't have to do anything. And the opposite is true. What happens when Adam sins in the Garden of Eden? What does God now tell him he will have to do? Now you're going to have to start to work. Which means being with God completely, having total trust in God, creates a situation where work is unnecessary. Why is work unnecessary? Because you have that total trust. Which means, let's just follow this through, you know, and make sure that we understand the concept. If man had a perfect God consciousness, could be we wouldn't even need to eat. Moses goes up and hangs out with God for 40 days and 40 nights, doesn't even need food. It could be if we had a perfect God consciousness, everything would be provided for us. It just appears in front of us, manna from heaven, or like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Now, if we have to start working as a punishment for having a lack of God consciousness, when God punishes, it's not simply to get back at you. Okay, you did this wrong, now you got to go to your room. You did this wrong. No, it means that we need what's called a tikkun. We need something to be fixed. We need to create a God consciousness. And that's where the whole idea of working comes in, and that's the whole idea specifically in the land of Israel. And what's so special about the land of Israel, where it's the work which leads you to focus back into heaven, which leads you to focus back upon God. Now, there's a double-edged street over here, and there's a problem. And that is that there are people that are hard-working people. And this, again, goes back to a concept in this week's parasha. There are people that are hard-working people. And when they really put in a hard day's work, they feel that it was them who did it. Kochi va'otzim yodi osa esachayel hazeh. My strength, the strength of my hand, is what created all of this might. Which means when a person works really hard and succeeds, you know, it's sort of like, you can phrase it this way, the self-made man who worships his creator. The self-made man feels that it's he who accomplished it. And we all know, there are some people who will work hard, accomplish a lot, and feel that it's totally them. It's their intelligence, it's their insight. And by the way, over the years that I've paid attention to such things, there are some really, really smart people who are rich, and there's some really, really smart people who are poor. There are some people who have great ideas who succeed, and some people who have great ideas who totally fall on their faces. If anybody's willing to go and do a study of this and show exactly what it is that creates one person's success and another person's failure, I mean, I'd love to see it. As far as I can tell, there's only one factor involved, which is a four-letter word, and that's luck. You can't tell me why this guy's product made it, this guy's product didn't make it, because there are so many factors involved in this. Luck, of course, is the non-religious perspective. Religious perspective would be that this person, God wanted to succeed, this person didn't want to succeed. Some people will succeed and just say, you know, basically, I won the lottery, figuratively, and that was God that did it. Another person would say, look how smart I am, I did this all myself, it was a lot of hard work on my own. I'm not belittling people's hard work. Again, I think that there is a great need for human beings to be involved in creative activity and to accomplish all kinds of things based on their hard work. But man needs to realize that when they work hard, what essentially they're doing is using their God-given gifts. And to a certain extent, I also find it fascinating that the very beginning of Genesis depicts God as a creator, God as a worker, God accomplishing something, God doing something, which therefore tells us that man, who then is described as being in the image of God, also is a creator, which means our creative activity, we should realize that that is a manifestation of our emulation of God and our using our ability which God gave us. Again, man can look at as I said before, you can have the self-made man who worships his creator and says, I am the one who did all this, and we're warned against this. Kolchi va'otzim yadi osa sachay lazeh. The individual says, it's my hand, it's my strength that created all this. You know, I'm often, you know, reminded of this particular concept when I think about the Israeli army. The Israeli army has a reputation, either rightfully or wrongfully, as being one of the best armies in the world. Now, I've served in this army. I've seen the way the army works. I actually spent the time in the war room for Central Command and seeing, you know, how things are done and things, what's going on over here. And the higher up you get in the army, the more you come to realization you have a lot of smart people who are working very hard, but for the grace of God, all of this would fall apart. And if it's when people, you know, get up and say that we have a strong army, we do this, we can defeat any, that's very, very frightening. When somebody says, we're going to work as hard as we can and hopefully God will help us out and we'll be successful, that's something completely, completely different. And the Talmud ultimately tells us that the failure of the failed Messiah, Bar Kochva, was when he turned to God and he said, listen, you don't have to help my soldiers, you don't have to hurt us, you know, we'll be successful ourselves. And that was the end of Bar Kochva. That he began to believe his press clippings and to believe that he himself had this incredible capacity. All this leads me to a section in the book of Genesis, Bereishis. We're told there of a very famous character named Adam, who at some point decided to plant some things, as he planted Eshel. There's a difference of opinion exactly what Eshel is, whether it was a paradise, fruit fields, or what exactly it was that he planted, what kind of food it was, whether it was just trees. According to the Medrash, one of the opinions is that Abraham planted this food, and his Eshel was an inn that he opened up at the very end of the desert. And that itself is interesting at the end, the location. Why would he... and those of you who don't realize exactly where Abraham lived, he lived around Beersheba, which, if you're coming up from the Negev, you're coming up through the desert, the Sinai Desert, that's the place that you're going to get. It's the end of the desert. Abraham, facing the desert, opens up an inn. And by near this inn, he plants all of these things. People come in, he gives them food. And when people give him, and when he gives people food, people then thank him and say to Abraham, thank you very much. And again, Abraham really seems to be one of the most illustrious characters, and aside from everything else, it is his kindness and his sharing and his giving. And in Kabbalistic literature, Abraham personifies the concept of chesed, the person who gives. But it could be that this is the major reason why he has this identity, one of chesed, because that he goes out of his way to create a situation that these travelers along the road will receive, you know, some kind of abundance, will receive some kind of food and so on. I mean, other people, you know, you think about pirates or someone like that, they'd stand, you know, also by the side of the road where people are traveling and go and attack them. Bless you. Abraham, that's where he sets up his inn. People come and travel. People come inside, come out of the desert. You know, I'm probably quite hungry, thirsty, tired. And Abraham gives them food, gives them a place to sleep and so on. And at the end, people would eat the food and say to Abraham, you know, Abraham, thank you very much. You know, you're really a very nice fellow. And Abraham would say, don't thank me, thank God. And that was the way that Abraham tried to bring people into this God consciousness. Now, what's interesting to me about this is, first of all, the location at the end of the desert. It seems to be that Abraham understands exactly, or if you want, I'll put it a little differently, there seems to be a direct parallel to what we're learning in this week's Parsha. The people, as they're getting to the very end of the desert and they're about to enter the land of Israel, now we need to develop this God consciousness. If you want, this was Abraham's ploy to bring God into the lives of the ancient idolaters in order for them to see, you know, to somehow give them this ability to lift their eyes heavenward and to say, thank God. But when it says in this week's Parsha, to v'achalta v'savata v'verachta, you know, to eat and to be satisfied and to bless God, that's what Abraham does, and that's the way that Abraham tries to connect to God, which means this is ultimately the one blessing which is really Torah mandated. That's the blessing that Abraham tries to connect people to. When we eat, we need to try to get to that kind of level. It means that you can live to eat or you can eat to live. But this seems to be somewhat different. We eat to live, but we eat to have a relationship with God, because that's ultimately what living is about. And every time that one eats, there is an opportunity at that moment to be able to connect to God. It could be that Adam and Eve, who hung out in the Garden of Eden, that's the level they should have been on. It could be the Jews who were in the desert. Maybe you don't even need to make a blessing on food. Maybe my question is a bad question. You don't need to make a blessing on manna. Why? Because the whole purpose of blessing is to connect you to heaven. And if you're eating manna from heaven, you're totally connected. But this is what Abraham understands. And that's what this week's parasha teaches us. And that really becomes the tool for a spiritual life, that every time one eats, to be able to say, thank you, God, for this, and to really feel it. And that ultimately becomes the tool to be able to stay in this land and to thrive in this land. Because this is a land which is different from other lands. This is a land which requires man to be focused up on God. In Kabbalistic literature, certainly the writings of the Vilna Gaon, it tells us how this is a land, and this is based on a verse in the Torah, that this is a land which is where the eyes of God are on this land all the time. There is this sense of hashkacha, that God is watching. I mean, maybe the way to phrase this, you can pray any place on this planet, or for that matter, if you go into outer space, you can pray as well. But you can play, you know, you pray in New York and New Jersey, you pray in other places. It's like a long distance call. When you pray over here, you're making the local call. And the way that the mystics describe this is that the prayers from all over the world, they travel up to Jerusalem, they come up to the Temple Mount, and from the Temple Mount is where they go up into heaven. And this land is the land where things go into heaven much easier, but things also come down from heaven much easier. Which means this is a land where God is watching people. For some people, that becomes a little too much, a little too intense, and you can't deal with it. You can't deal with it. You want to hide from God. Just as Adam and Eve hid from God, what happens then? They get kicked out of the Garden of Eden. They can't keep that kind of a relationship. And then what happens? Man has to work. But work does not become the end. Work becomes the means whereby man should realize that ultimately life is a partnership with God. Using our God-given traits, using our God-given ability, using our image of God which is within us, to realize our accomplishments are because God gave us this ability. And then once we have the divine abundance in our hands, once we have the physical abundance in our hands, once we have the fruits of it, literal fruits of labors in our hands, at that moment we need to lift our eyes heavenward and to say, thank God. When one is able to do this, one will then have developed what I call the spiritual consciousness. If we're able to do this collectively, then we're really able to deserve to live in this land. And that's really one of the tests that this generation has. Instead of like many, many generations who stood outside the land of Israel and prayed and hoped and dreamed that one day they'll come back, now we're back over here. Once we're back, we can make the mistake and say, "Kochi v'yotzim adi osa zechay l'zeh." It's my ingenuity, my strength, my creativity which has created all this. Or I can say, look, Baruch Hashem, thank God, look what we have been able to accomplish with the help of God. Creating the God consciousness is really what can take us to the next level, where divine reality becomes that much more manifest. Okay. Have a good Shabbos.